The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Runes, the 2018 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2018. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Good afternoon, everybody. Can you all hear me fine? All right. If I stand back here, can you hear me fine? Okay, because I travel a little bit sometimes when I talk, so I'll try to stay in one area. If y'all don't mind, let's open with a word of prayer real quick. Father, we thank you for this time together, and I thank you for just the privilege of coming here and the opportunity for all of us to get together. We pray very simply that we honor you. In Christ's name, amen. So if you're not seated, come on in, have a seat, get some water if you need it. I've passed out some bookmarks at the doors and different things. You don't need to look at those now. If you don't have one, you can grab one on the way out. I'll tell you a little bit about myself. My name is Keith McCurdy. I've been in the mental health field for about 30 years. Recently, I served 8 years on the board of a Christian classical school in Roanoke, Virginia, Faith Christian. I've been the board chair for the past 6. I just retired. I tried to turn my key into them, and they said, hold on to it for 1 year. You might come back. So I know the ins and outs of mental health, also serving on the board of a Christian school. So it's been an experience. But what we're going to talk about today, hopefully, is what affects the children that you see and the parents that you see as you teach, as you're an administrator, or even as you're just a parent in your school. So hopefully we'll tell some stories and have a little fun. Anytime I leave for a conference, my wife always tells me, The same thing we've told our children for years: whenever you go out in public, do not embarrass the family. So we'll see how we do with that. My son, who has his words of wisdom. My son is 17. He is 6'5". He has a full beard. He can grow in a week and then shave it and grow it again in a week. You know, a real classical student with the big beard. He is a multi-sport athlete with championships in a couple different venues. He says, tell any story about me you want. And then I have a daughter who is a rising senior in college, who was also educated in a Christian classical school. And she says, oh, whatever you do, just don't tell stories about me. So let's start with a story about my daughter. And my daughter's name is Sarah, and you have to understand her personality. She is, I'll tell you a few things about her so you get the picture. She is about 6 feet tall. She was a varsity basketball player. Her nickname was Bones, not because she was skinny, but because she could hurt you. And her teammates named her that. Other teams were afraid to play her, and she loved it. She is an accomplished equestrian at the high school level, at the collegiate level. And when she was little, 6 or 7 years old, I was watching one of her lessons, and it was the first time she had actually been thrown from a horse, really whipped off the horse into a crossrail. And I happened to be there, and I jumped up, and the trainer across the ring jumped up, and my daughter jumped up and slugged the horse in the side of the head. Right in the side of the head. And the trainer looks across the ring at me and goes, and so I sit back down. So that is my daughter's makeup. She has always been that way. She, as she would say, she does not suffer fools well. She will be the first to tell you that the dress code is dorky. That this teacher has been teaching way too long and needs to be gone. So when she graduated from school, she was accepted into an extremely competitive program. She was one of about a dozen students in the nation accepted into this design and architecture program. And her first day of class was in a studio. And it was a studio that had freshmen to seniors of both programs, architecture and design. So she estimated there was 100 people in there. So after her first 3-hour studio class, I get a text message from my daughter, the one you have just pictured. And it said, I have never been more thankful in my life for my education at Faith Christian School, in a Christian classical school. So knowing who my daughter is, do you think I had to call her? Oh, yeah. So I call her. I say, what on earth happened to your first day of college, your first college class ever? She said it was unbelievable. A 3-hour class, top-tier students in the nation. She and one other student were the only two that spoke for 3 hours to the professor. And she recognized immediately that a huge part of that was the education that you all provide. She knew who she was, whose she was, and she knew how to communicate and engage. And she was able to recognize immediately. She said, I knew in the first 5 minutes that school had spoken that into my life. So right off the bat, thank you all for what you do. You do a great job. You do something that most people do not do in the world of education. So first thing we want to talk about is, where are we today? Where are we with our children? In the last 6 months, I've spoken in front of about 1,000 upper school students. And I often ask this question. I say, how would the world around you describe your generation? Somebody give me what you think I heard. What do you think? How would the world describe your generation, the teenage world?
Entitled,
I got that. Snowflakes, I got fragile. Snowflakes. Yeah, I got addicted to technology. I got worthless. Unskilled, not capable, depressed, anxious. These are regular terms I get every school that I go to from the upper school students. To the question of, how does the world view you? So then I ask the follow-up question, and I ask them to raise their hands. I say, how many of you view your peers that way? Virtually all of them raise their hands. Which means we know what they think of themselves at some level. That's shocking, folks. And so when we look at the current situation of our teenagers today, let's look at some statistics. I often give this statistic because I think it demonstrates a trend. You know, it's very easy for us to get stuck in looking at just millennials, looking at just generation X or Y or Z, but we have to look at the whole history of where we have gone with our children to really understand the trouble we may or may not be in. And so if you think about where we are today, in 1986, I was graduating high school. Yes, I know some of you were not alive then. Some of you were. The ratio of students on psychiatric meds, school-age students, 5 to 18, 1 in 400. That's not bad. You know, one in a school, one in a medium-sized, small school, not bad at all. In the year 2000, that ratio went from 1 in 400 to 1 in 40. 2013, that ratio went to 1 in 13. So from 86 to 2013, we went from 1 in a school, many of your schools are probably in that size range, to a couple in a classroom. The soft number right now, I'm waiting on statistics, I even checked last night online with the CDC, we're right at 1 in 7 right now. 1 in 7 of our school-age children, 5 to 18, if they're still in school, are on psychiatric meds. Now, what happened between 86 and now that was traumatic in the lives of our children, our developing children into teenagers, that can justify that? I see the phone holding up, technology. That's not traumatic in nature, though. We can't find that. That type of change of quote, the need for medication would have to be driven by something traumatic, would it not? But we cannot find it. Think about these statistics. The number of children under the age of 5 on psychiatric meds currently. It's over 1 million. The number of children on psychiatric meds under the age of 1. It's over 260,000. That is, those are 2016 numbers. I will guarantee you they are higher now. Most people may assume those children at that young of an age are on those meds because of hyperactivity and things like that. What else could you, of course, diagnose when they're under the age of 1? Actually, less than 1,500 of those children are on stimulant meds. Most of the meds given to children under the age of 1 are based on anxiety. I've been in the business 30 years. I don't know how you diagnose anxiety in a child that's less than 1 year old, right? But that's the picture we have. Now, if we look backwards in history, we get a very different picture of childhood. Just go back to 1950. How many children under the age of 5 did we have on psychiatric meds? We don't have a record of it. Isn't that crazy? I'm sure someone was prescribing something maybe in that realm. We actually didn't have an explosion in any significant way of psychiatric meds till the mid-1980s with Prozac. When Prozac hit the market, we just kind of went boom with psychiatric meds. So that's the population we're dealing with. We're dealing with a population that, in one word, is extremely fragile when we look at them. Now, if you go backwards and you look at, I'll give you a way to picture this child. Think of Little House on the Prairie, 1880s, 1890s America. Everyone seen Little House on the Prairie? Yes, okay. Think about children then. What was the average 13-year-old young woman doing in 1880s, 1890s? Helping mom, what else? Yeah, farming, working on the farm, working in the house. Basically every function of mother, not necessarily wife until 15 and 16 and 17. It's cooking, it's cleaning, it's every function of a home. I call it the chicken sandwich story by comparison. If you want a chicken sandwich today, where do you go? You give the right classical Christian answer. Where do you go? Chick-fil-A. You better say Chick-fil-A, or you are losing funding if you don't say Chick-fil-A. In 1880, what had to happen if you wanted a chicken sandwich? And that's where the fun began. You had to go kill a chicken. And young women were doing that without thinking about it. What did a young man, a 13-year-old young man in 1880, 1890, know how to do? You name it. They knew how to do every function of life. The typical 13-year-old, if we go back and look at historical record, the typical 13-year-old young adult, woman and man, functioned capability-wise at a higher level than our graduating college students do today, across the board. And we have virtually any record of anxiety and depression in the late 1800s, early 1900s, to a significant level, anything that we would call as a crisis or a major trend. That is scary. So how on earth have we gotten here? Well, this is where we get to make fun of my profession. My profession has done a ton of this. To set that up and to give you a couple categories, I had a phone call a couple weeks ago from a graduate student at a university who had heard a podcast or something I did and as a project wanted to call me. And at the end of the conversation, she had a list of questions. And she said, my last question, in all your years of doing this, can you see any trend? Is there any one thing you see more than another? Is there any one problem you see more than anything else? And I said, absolutely, two things. One, we are dealing with a population of children and teenagers that are more fragile than they've ever been. They do not know how to handle the normal rigors of life. And two, we have now pretty much a second generation of parents that have to be given permission to parent. They've lost that mantle. So let's deal with the first piece. Let's deal with the whole notion of fragile and how my profession has played into that. If you look back in history, psychology and the idea of psychology, studying the mind and behavior, predates Freud. But Freud began the idea of therapeutic psychology with psychoanalysis. Freud was trained as a neurologist. He really wasn't a psychiatrist in the sense of the meaning that we know today. And a lot of people will say, you know, Freud really didn't have much to, we don't listen to Freud today, basically. Well, that's not true. Freud gave us a couple interesting things. Freud was an extreme Darwinist. He was very moved by Darwin's writings. And Freud, number one, told us that our life is deterministic. Our future is dictated by our past, controlled by our past. Now, the crazy thing is, if you really think about it, Freud was an extreme sexist, because if you had a condition today and you struggled greatly, it was because of some trauma in your past. And who typically was the person that perpetuated that trauma on you? Your mother. That's horrible. But Freud set in motion the notion that our past determines who we are, rather than us being a new creation with the old gone and the new coming. Basically, he said, our history tells us who we are and how we're going to be, rather than just someplace we have been. The second thing Freud did is Freud turned how we look at the being and said, truth lies within us. And the answer to our struggles lies within us. And that is a shift from the truth being transcendent and outside of us. And so Freud began the movement of helping individuals look inside themselves to find truth and fulfillment in their life. Now, from Freud, we had more Freudians, neo-Freudians, but that movement of psychoanalysis and evaluating ourselves grew for many years until we hit the next big pillar shift in psychology, and that is the behaviorists. The biggest, the most famous one, if you're trained in education, you took a course and you learned about B.F. Skinner. Skinner was also a Darwinist. Skinner believed that there is no free will. Everything is determined. Well, the problem with that is what Skinner and Freud didn't understand and didn't accept is something we know, that we're the only species on Earth that doesn't grow to full adult functional size and ability by 18 months. Every other species does. Can you imagine your 18-month-old being as big as you? Imagine changing that diaper. I mean, that'd just be horrific. The reality is we have free will, we are broken, and we require training. Yet, for 20, 30 years, we have been inundated with behavioral strategies of how to raise your children. How many people in here have used a token system in their home or a check chart, not just to monitor that something is accomplished, but to actually maneuver behavior? If you have, raise your hand. We won't make fun of you. Right. All right. Anybody? How long did it last?
2 months.
2 months? Wow, that's one of the longest I've ever heard. That's amazing. Yeah. Because children are smart. They learn how to rig the system. You know, they're gaming it. I'll tell you a quick story. I had a kid that came in to see me, and he was getting in trouble in the school system. And he would walk in the room, and he would sit down, and somewhere during the course of the day, he would hit somebody. And so the school counselor came up, who was a behaviorist, came up with the idea that we can correct this. And the idea was, well, you know you have this issue, but if you will apologize and make amends and make it right, we're going to reward that behavior, because that's really what we want. No, we want you not to hit somebody. But so what do you think happened? This kid, every time he would apologize and make amends, he would get a token. Every time he earned so many tokens, he could go to the toy box and get a toy at the end of the week. What happened? The toy box was empty in 2 weeks. This kid couldn't walk in the school building without smacking somebody. He was smart. He figured out the more people I hit, the more times I can earn something. And that's where I got it. I mean, that's what behaviorism does. It lets us look at folks and gives us the idea that we can actually control outcome. We can't control outcome, folks. We may be able to speak into the life of a child, but we absolutely cannot control outcome. The only time we really have control over a child is before they crawl. It's called location. We can put them there and they cannot get away. From the moment they begin crawling, then walking, then running, we are losing more and more control of them. So that idea is a myth. After behaviorism, we came slamming into where we are still today, which is humanism. I call it a progressive humanism. Humanism, the simplest way to understand it is the feel-good movement. We are going to build the self-esteem of your child so high that they will be the greatest person on earth. Well, has it worked? No, it hasn't worked at all. I'll give you one thing that we have learned after now studying this for about 30 years, 25, 30 years. The higher the self-esteem, the lower regard for others. The higher the self-esteem, reported self-esteem on self-esteem inventories, the lower regard we have for others. I don't think that's the direction we should be going. I thought the direction we were to go is teaching selflessness. What psychology has done is this. In the last 30 years, primarily 40 years, really since the 80s, it's done three key things. Number one, it has elevated the role of the expert. Historically, who were the expert on raising children? Parents. If you have a problem with a child today, who do you go see? Me. We have convinced, psychology has convinced parents that they don't know what they're doing. We do it by changing the language. We have that wonderful manual, the DSM. We're now in the DSM-5. We come up with our own terms. As we know in the Christian classical world, language is power, right? We have things like trivium. You know, hopefully by the time a child graduates, the parent understands what the trivium means. But, you know, hopefully we're communicating that well. But in psychology, we come up with diagnostic codes. What folks don't understand is the DSM is a symptom classification system that is not based on research. All of the research that is in the DSM is research that has done after a group of folks agree on a symptom picture. They then go do research to say how often it occurs. If you read the very beginning of the DSM, there's actually a disclaimer that explains that. Yet, that's not how it's presented to parents. It's presented as, we have a knowledge that you do not have. We have an understanding that you do not have. And so you come to us and we will give you a diagnostic code or a label. And when you get that label, we have just prescribed what your treatment is. So we have replaced the parent. How many parenting books existed prior to 1950 that were readily available to the average parent? 1946, Spock released his book. Guess what? Spock's was not readily available. There were no, think about books. We did not have Amazon in 1946, folks, right? It was out there, but it was only out there really for the professionals. I mean, that book was not readily available in 46. That's when it was printed. We had one. If you go on Amazon today and you go under books and you look up how many books you can find on family and parenting, it's over 100,000 on any given day. How can they all be right? It's crazy. Talk about a lot of cooks in the kitchen. So the first thing we did, though, is we convinced parents, you do not know your children as well as we know your children. The second thing we did is we told the child, the most important thing in your world is how you feel. My daughter tells me all the time, she says, do people know you're a walking trigger warning and a professional at microaggressions? And I said, honey, microaggressions by definition are not a big deal, right? It's microaggression, so who cares? You know, we have convinced children that how they feel, and we have convinced parents that a state of happiness is the goal of life. If you go back to 1920 and talk to one of my grandparents and you say, what's the goal for your children? They will say, I want someone of sturdy character, someone who is honest, someone who is hardworking, someone who knows how to do right in the face of wrong. They're talking, those are formational statements of aspiring after a transcendent truth about what it is to be healthy. You talk to the average parent today, what do you want for your child? I want them to be happy, I want them to be rich, marry somebody good looking, and have a lot of awards. And that's what you hear. Three generations ago, what was the biggest fear of parents? That my child will be a juvenile delinquent. So I'm going to form character. What is the biggest fear? Number one fear every year, number one fear of moms of teenagers today. Number one, that their children will kill themselves. Am I right? Yeah. You all can't see, but all the heads nodding. So if our number one fear is, I don't want to have a juvenile delinquent, then I inform character. If my number one fear is, I don't want my child to kill themselves, then I work really hard to keep them happy. Here's the problem with emotions. A good friend of mine was in South Bronx. He got held up at a stoplight in his car in the winter with the windows up in South Bronx. Guy walked up, put a gun right through his window, and held him up. So South Bronx is kind of a dangerous place. Anybody here from South Bronx? No? Okay. Imagine you're there, and you meet a friend, and you hear there's a great Italian restaurant in the South Bronx, and you guys are going to go to dinner. So you take the subway, you go to dinner, you come out, it's dark. You say, oh, hold up, got to go to the restroom. I'll be right back. You go to the restroom, you come back, your friend's gone. And you think, I know where she went. She went to the subway station. I'm going to go this way and run through the alley and catch up to her. So you take off. It's dark. You're in South Bronx. You run through the alley, and a bunch of guys run in the alley after you. How do you feel? Scared? Okay. Now you're home in bed, and you dream the same scenario. How do you feel in the dream? Scared. Anybody ever woken up in fright? Woo! You know, yes, we all have. Now you're in a movie theater, and there's a movie that's a little scary, and all of a sudden something jumps on that screen, and you jump. In that moment, how do you feel? Fright. In the first example in the South Bronx in the alley, are you in danger? Yes. When you're laying in bed dreaming, are you in danger? No. When you're in the theater, can anything on that screen hurt you? Our feelings, our emotions cannot tell the difference between fantasy and reality. It is the most often experienced part of our brokenness on a daily basis. The fact that our emotional world is a broken compass. So why on earth would we want to elevate an emotional state as a goal for anyone? That would be like me taking some of my Boy Scouts out in the mountains, breaking all their compasses, and saying, here's your map and your compass, go north. They'd end up all over the place. But that's what we do in psychology. The third thing we've done in psychology is we have changed the perspective dynamic of the family. We have gone through now what I call the democratic family. That was the last 20 years or so, which is Johnny gets a seat at the table. And you know, heads of schools or admissions folks, you get this every year. Mom and dad say, yeah, we really haven't talked to Johnny about whether or not he wants to come back here next year. He's in third grade. We all go through that. We hear it all the time. But that's the democratic family. It's the notion in psychology that children have a voice. We have to hear them. So we've elevated them to get a seat at the table. But we now have cruised right through that, and we're now in the therapeutic family model. And the therapeutic family model is Johnny's at the head of the table. His seat's a little elevated, and our job's to keep him satisfied. I run into that in my office all the time. What that has led to is maybe one of the biggest issues that psychology has caused. And understand, when I talk about psychology, I'm not necessarily picking on folks in my field. I know a ton of folks in my field that I think are great folks. I'm picking on the field of psychology because it doesn't hold truth. It's a pseudoscience. I'll give you an example. When folks come to me for a job, I talk to them about their training, and I say, well, here's the reality. Here's psychology. Here's scripture. Do you take scripture and shove it through psychology? Or do you take psychology and shove it through the sieve of scripture? Scripture holds truth. Psychology does not. And what psychology has done in the process has now told us, in essence, that struggle is bad. It has convinced us of that. I have parents in my office all the time that cannot stand the fact that their child will be unhappy, throw a tantrum, cry, be upset about something. And I tell them very clearly, unless you're willing for your child to be upset, suffer, and struggle, you're really no good for them. That goes over well usually, by the way. That's a microaggression, according to my daughter. And the reality is, when folks ask me, they say, what is your favorite scripture on parenting? And we can talk about Deuteronomy and pressing truth. We can talk about Proverbs, training up children. And I say, no, it's the beginning of the book of James. The method. Now, we're told what to do. Early in scripture, we're told we are to impress truth. But the method for that process is the beginning of the book of James. And I will absolutely paraphrase, because if not, I'll butcher it if I try to repeat it correctly. Consider pure joy, my brethren, whenever you face trials, struggles of any kind. Develops perseverance, the ability to stick with something when it's hard. Perseverance must finish its work so that we are mature. That, to me, in the world that I deal with in psychology, is the most valuable verse on parenting, because it is one of the key struggles parents have today, not allowing their children to struggle. And until we can allow our children to struggle, they are off in fantasy land, running on their emotions. And that's a big problem. We see it in the school system all the time. So if that's the fragile part, the the parents needing permission to parent part is the fact that psychology has told them they're not experts anymore. Well then, okay, what's our target then? What's our goal? Well, I'm going to give you a definition of a word, and the word's maturity. And it's got three key components. The first component of maturity comes out of Deuteronomy 6, which is knowing what is right, wise, true, good, lovely, beautiful. We have to know that. We as parents are to instill that. I love that passage. When they wake up, when they lie down, when they walk along the road. I love on the door frames and on the fence post. That is, they need to see it coming and going. If it's on your door frame and it's on your fence post, whether they're coming or going, they're constantly going to see truth. It means we are to weave truth into the fabric of their daily experience. Doesn't mean we're to preach it then. But that's the first part of maturity, is that we have truth. That we know what is true. And that has nothing to do with us. The second part of maturity is an emotional awareness. And that has two components. The first component is that our emotions actually are valuable. I was speaking a couple years ago one place, and a guy raised his hand. So are you saying our emotions are not valuable at all? I said, no, they're very valuable. You can't trust them, but they're very valuable. I'll give you two simple ways to look at emotions. One way to look at it is we have emotions to fully, with all of our being, experience God's creation. And we have emotions to fully, with all of our being, to experience the depth of relationship God calls us into when he says two will become one. There is a wonderful purpose, a wonderful role of emotions in our life. But it is not to direct our behavior or our decisions. So we have to have knowing what's right. We have to have an emotional awareness that our emotions are valuable, but they are not reliable. And then the ultimate action in this model is that when the two aren't equal, meaning I know what the right thing to do is, I just don't want to do it, the act of maturity is I do it anyway. I have written that model, drawn a little model of it on my board for 30 years for every teenager that comes in my office. And I have said, after I speak to them for an hour or for a session or two, I'll say, can I show you what I think your biggest issue is that you face in life every single day? This is every teenager who has walked in my office. I've treated 15,000 of them. And I draw that model, and I say, am I not right that your biggest struggle is doing what you know to be right? It's not that you don't know what's right. Most of the time, luckily, thankfully, most kids I deal with and teenagers, I say, in these situations, did you kind of know what the best thing to do is? Luckily, somehow, they still say, well, yeah. You know, heads of schools dealing with kids that come to their office, most of the time, the kids are like, yeah, you know, not the boys that are in first grade, though. What was the right thing to do? Kill and destroy, you know. That's their job. They're in first grade. That's their goal. So I draw this on the board for them, and I say, am I not right? I've never had a teenager disagree with me that their biggest struggle isn't any one issue. It's this process. It's the process of owning the fact that their brokenness means their emotions are distorted and they have a hard time not following distorted emotions, choosing what is true. If we are going to pursue that, teaching maturity, targeting maturity, we have to accept that struggle is the process. We have to. So when I engage parents, what I say to parents is this. I say, look, I'm going to give you five things that will begin to change how you deal with your children. And the first thing I tell parents is this. I say, you need to claim who you are. You need to have a family identity. You know, I don't use too many psychobabble words, but I get to use one now. Boundaries. Boundaries in the sense of you are drawing a boundary around your family, and you do that by what you say yes to and what you say no to. Very simply, you do it by what you say yes to and what you say no to. There is nothing that is neutral. And so it forces parents to actually evaluate all the things they're allowing in their children's lives. And to drive a stake in the ground and say, yeah, we're saying no to that, we're saying yes to this. I'll give you examples. Do you say yes or no to video games? My son will laugh with his friends because my son has never had a video game. My son will say, yeah, we don't have video games, but we shoot stuff and blow stuff up. We do. You know? I was sharing with Aaron Gentry. My son, as I was flying out of Charlotte yesterday, my son, 17-year-old, remember the one with the big beard, real tall kid, sent me a text making fun of me, basically, like, wish you were here. He and a buddy decided the night before, middle of the night, he's kind of like a first grader, that they were going to go hike and do an overnight day hike and come back. And so the picture is my son standing on a 4,000-foot cliff, almost 4,000-foot, at sunrise, yes, on the edge of the cliff. And he sends me the picture, not his mother, who I checked a little while ago, and she still has not seen the picture, which is probably pretty good, you know. But, you know, we have got to say yes to things that are good, no to things that are not. Whether it's video games, whether it's sleepovers. Folks, sleepovers in today's world are the first introduction to drug use, inappropriate sexual contact. Those two things skyrocket. And think about it. Here's what I get from parents. But they're only in third grade. Okay. You're taking a bunch of third graders, putting them together. In the middle of the night when you're sleeping, they have virtually no self-control, jacking them up on pizza and caffeine, thinking all will go well. That's not a good scenario at all. My grandmother used to say nothing good happens after 10 o'clock. According to crime statistics, she's kind of right. My kids have grown up with the idea that, you know, once it's like 10 o'clock at night, we're shutting down. We're respecting the way God has built us, and he's built our bodies typically to shut down a little bit after 9, 9:30, you know, the way melatonin works in the body. My daughter went to college, and she said, it is crazy here. Everyone wants to go out at 10:30 at night, and I want to go to bed. I'm like, yay, you know. But so the first thing is boundaries. What do we say yes to? What do we say no to? You will get pushback. You will be the crazy family who doesn't allow video games, who doesn't do sleepovers, but you begin crafting identity to your children, because when your children say, why do we not do that, you have an answer, and it's an answer based on truth. It's not healthy, and you can explain why. My children have grown up hearing, once you have an identity, things like this. Yeah, we just don't do that. Not in this family. Or, yeah, we do that. A good friend of mine, he's got a little boy, and he thinks this way, and he tells his children certain things that are identity statements. So his son is a kindergartner, and I go up and I say, what's your name? And he says, Johnson! And what do? We work hard. That kid will remember that forever. That's an identity statement based on good character that has been woven into his life by his mom and dad. Just one example. I think it's hysterical. Anytime I see him out in public and his dad's like, quit asking him. I mean, we can be anywhere. Who are you? And he, you know, I'm a Johnson. You know, it's really funny. The second thing is do less and require more of your children. Harvard Grant study, if you've ever heard of it, tracks baby boomers from very young children. We're still tracking them. Every few years, the Harvard Grant study kicks out some correlation. So last year, beginning of last year, the correlation they kicked out was what in childhood, now this is not what the people report. This is just the aspects they know of their childhood from all the information they've gained. What in your childhood correlated the highest with you in your retirement years being the most satisfied with life? The number one thing by far that shocked the researchers, and it was the number one by far, was they had chores. The younger they were when they had chores, the higher level of satisfaction they reported in life. Well, I'm sorry, but chores are the beginning of struggle and suffering. They just are. And I ask this question, I'll ask it to you all. How many of you have children? Great. How many? What chore in your home can your children, and if they're older now, when they were younger, when they were elementary school, what chore or job in your home can your children not do unless it's based on physical development? Can you think of one? Guess what? That's the answer I usually get. All right, how many of those chores are you turning over to them? That's a great answer. There are three things children have to have answered in life to be able to then move on to know that they are loved by God and by us. The three questions are this: am I valuable? Do I have meaning? Am I capable? Can I actually do this? And then, do I fit anywhere? Do I belong to something? Well, one of the most grounding things we can do with our children that begins to answer all three of those is making them a contributing member of our family. We've hit on all three of those. Those questions are now asked by teenagers, college students, and adults all the time. Why am I here? What's my value? What's my meaning? Can I actually do this? We have millennials getting jobs right now, and the number one complaint from companies hiring millennials is they can't make a decision. They can't make a decision. Guess what process in life makes us good decision makers? Struggle. Because struggle has a natural built-in evaluative process, and it makes us start to realize things and learn things. And when we don't struggle, we don't learn to process information. We can't make a decision. So when we begin to put chores in the lives of our children, and here's the model I give folks. If you go back to Little House on the Prairie again, as soon as a child demonstrated a functional ability, we gave them a reason to use it. That happened between the ages of 2 and 3, when they had basic mastery of speech and mobility. As soon as you could grab sticks, you helped haul wood. As soon as you could reach the sink, you washed dishes. As soon as you could crank the handle, you pulled up water. As soon as you were tall enough and strong enough to lift a harness to put it on a horse, you were helping put things on horses. That is not how we raise our children today. We make it easy. Life 100 years ago, as a comparison, was simple but hard. We required a lot and gave little. Life today is easy but complex. We give a lot and require a little. 100 years ago, we had children that were equipped to be young adults. Guy I worked with named Joe, lied about his age, went into World War II at 15. Flew in a bomber squadron over Europe. Got out when he was 17. He said, I was illegal the whole time. But he wasn't alone. We won't let 15-year-olds boil water. I had a mom in my office the other day, and we were talking about her daughter that's anxious. And I said to the mother, the daughter was not there, I said, your daughter's anxious because she doesn't know how to even say boo. The daughter's 14, doesn't know how to do a single function that relates to her daily existence in life. Mom got it and said, I won't even let her light a candle at the dinner table. The dad said, I cut her food up for her. She's 14. I'm like, I was like a major microaggression at that moment. So what I tell parents is we begin to require more and do less of our children. Third thing, connect cause and effect, the basic learning tool of childhood. Let me explain that. Little Johnny, I go to Little Johnny, instead of saying, clean your room, clean your room, clean your room, clean your room, now let me tell you all the merits of cleaning your room, now let me lecture. We do that as if Little Johnny's going to say, oh my gosh, Mom, Dad, now that you've explained that, I'm going to go clean my room, and I'm going to walk the dog and wash the neighbor's car because it's going to build my character. Folks, that's never going to happen. We need to be quiet. Cause and effect is going to Johnny again when he's 5 and saying, hey, I don't care when you clean your room. You can't do anything else till it's done. Because when they're 5, we don't control them, but we absolutely control the world around them. And for parents that say, but he has too much stuff in his room, I look at them, I say, exactly. So get all the toys out. Yeah, but hold him accountable to it. The vast majority of children, over 95%, unless they have a pervasive developmental delay, which has a very small percentage walking the earth, Unless they're in that group, within an hour, a day, a week, what will that little Johnny do? They will clean the room. I have 30 years of experience with that with kids. Now, they may trash it. I had one mom that told me, she got it. She was on with it. He flipped out, trashed his room, pulled everything off the bookshelf, and she waited till it got calm again, and she opened the door, and she went, wow! you just made it a lot harder, and shut the door back. That little kid, just so you know, he did respond by urinating down the heat exchange in his room. The mom didn't miss a beat on that either. She said, wow, the dad's like, she totally threw me under the bus. The mom said, you and dad get to go downstairs and disassemble that and clean it out, which they had to do before he was free again. She saw me many years later, probably just a few years ago, and ran into me. We were laughing about that in a grocery store. And she said, you know, every fall, for like 5 minutes, we smelled little Johnny's tantrum. They couldn't get it all cleaned out of the heat vent. So we begin connecting cause and effect. A simple way to do this with parents, especially grammar school students, I tell parents, quit fussing at them about homework. Say to your child when you come home, hey, have a snack, and I don't really care what you do, but you can't do anything you want to do until you do your homework. So you can lay on the floor and whistle show tunes. It's okay. But everything else I control is off the table. Well, be careful. Now we run into the sacred cow of extracurricular activities or travel sports, right? How many of you run into that? But Johnny's got intramural water polo and, you know, flamenco dancing and all this. So I'll tell you a true story. Mom comes to me and she walks in and sits down in my office. She said, I can't wait to tell you what's wrong. I've been waiting to come to see you. We were driving to soccer practice, and little Johnny was yelling and screaming and cussing at me. So I'm pulling in the parking lot, and I said, whoa, stop! She said, I haven't told you the problem. I said, yes, you did. You're still driving to soccer practice. She said, he's the star goalie. I said, I don't care who he is, but the team needs him. I said, whoa, no. I said, if you're going to work with me, he's done until he can be respectful to the family. The coach will flip out. Tell the coach to call me. The coach called me. Coach called my office. I got him on the phone. It was one of these where I'm like, hey, coach. You know, he took a breath. And I said, coach, I got one question for you. What's more important, for Johnny to be a contributing member of your team or for him to first be a contributing member of his family? The coach slammed the phone down, never called me again. I mean, we can recognize truth typically when we see it. You know, we have got to decide that our children have to learn to function first in our families before we move them out into the other arena. And a simple connection of cause and effect does that. Fourth thing, limit technology. We have to work to make technology a smaller footprint in our home. It is not. The average adult checks their phone unprompted 80 plus times a day. How many? Think about it. You pick it up just to see if you missed something. Right? We're all guilty of that. That's called addiction. And guess what? We were fully developed before the smartphone was introduced. Our children are not. If we struggle with that addictive behavior, it is running the brains of our children. So one of the first things we have to do is make it a smaller footprint. And I'm not going to go on about technology, but I'm going to give you one perspective to think about. Because I got in a fight the other day with Chuck Knox on Cross Politic. They interviewed me, and Chuck was pushing back because I think he's a big gamer. And he loves his technology. Train the skill before you provide the technology to make it easy. Train the skill. Teach our children how to read, including cursive, before we allow them to use a word processor. Train math before we give them a calculator. I told my son and daughter, and they think, you know, I'm like 9,000 years old. I said, I did not get to use a calculator on my SAT. I didn't get to use one. They use calculators on the SAT, graphing calculators. That's crazy to me. My daughter's response to that was, well, that's your fault. I mean, But so with technology, if you just frame it that way, that we're going to teach the skill before we allow it to be replaced with what's convenient or what's easy. My son, who's 17, the one with the big beard, he was on staff. If you are familiar with HOBE, Hugh O'Brien Leadership, some of y'all know, leadership training thing. He was asked to go down. He was in it last year, asked to go down to be a trainer this year at NC State, 4 hours from where I live. And he's a rising senior, and he said, so can I drive on my own? You know, doesn't want mom and dad taking him down. Bye! To a leadership conference. And I said to my son, I said, how are you going to get there? And he goes, oh, I've already pulled it up on my phone. I said, well, what if your phone dies? And he goes, and disappears. Comes back 30, 40 minutes later with the Rand McNally Road Atlas, and he had already highlighted his route. And his comment basically was, am I good? You can go now. Yeah, he has to have the skill before I'm going to allow him to rely on technology. Because when technology fails, if you don't have the skill, that's a problem. Fifth thing, balance activities. Now, let me give you a model, and you can draw it. You know what a bullseye looks like? Ring in the middle, a second ring, and a third ring. And this, parents ask me all the time, is there a simple model for understanding parenting? I said, yeah, use this one. In the center of that circle, you write what the kid job is. It's three words: respect, responsibility, and school. Respect. A lot of stuff falls under respect, folks. What we believe, our attitudes, how we treat each other. Responsibility, that presupposes we have given our children responsibilities, and they have to do them and do them well. And school, we want them to do their best in school. Please don't try to hammer your kids for straight A's. You know, the research we have on all the, I'm not saying you want all your kids to be millionaires, but the millionaires, the average GPA of millionaires in the United States is like a 2.9 or 3.0 in college. You know. But those three things are in the middle. And the next ring is in home, or in parentheses, simple, freedoms and privileges. In home, in parentheses, simple, freedoms and privileges. In the last ring, third ring out, or second ring out, is out of home, in parentheses, elaborate, freedoms and privileges. You got the model written down? In the center is respect, responsibility, school. First ring is in-home, simple, freedoms and privileges. The next ring is out-of-home, elaborate, freedoms and privileges. You got it? Well, let me tell you how most families parent today. We are already from birth out at the elaborate, out-of-home freedoms and privileges, and then we're constantly saying to our children, do you not see what I do for you? Why won't you do this? Do you not know how much money we spend on you? Why are you not doing this? Sound familiar? We need to reverse it. We look at our children, and this is how we keep things in balance. And we say, here's your job. When you demonstrate you're doing it well, you get to bump out to the next category. You know, might change your bedtime, might let you do a few more things, watch some TV shows, whatever it is you allow in your home. And as long as you then still maintain that center circle, and you're doing that second one and still doing well, we bump you to the third. And if now you're getting both simple and elaborate freedoms and privileges, and you're still maintaining respect, responsibility in school, that outer circle begins to expand. And then when that center stops moving, we make your world small again. And we look at you and say, yeah, you know, you just made your world small. We're going to keep it small till you show us you can do it well again. And then we slowly progress you out again. It puts everything in the right order. That's how we begin to balance activities. We are 2 minutes, no, 5 minutes from time, 7 minutes from time. I want to give time for questions. You can ask me anything. What do you want to know? What do you want to ask? Yes, you got to be loud. Yeah, there's a ton of research on that, and it's not pretty. We know right now that the average school-age child has 7.5 hours of screen time a day. Some of that's doubled up, watching TV and on your laptop. I think that was Kaiser Family Foundation did that. The average student from 6th to 12th grade has 10,000 hours of video games by the time they graduate, average in the United States. So here's what we know. We know that stimulus response in what technology does with it. Well, let me back up. Your iPhone, why are your apps on your iPhone? They're not there to make your life easier. If they make your life easier, that's a good thing, They're there because they've demonstrated they can make money. They've demonstrated they can capture a portion of the population who will click something enough times and use the app or use the advertising that they've been able to quantify a demographic and sell it. Okay, that's the nature of addiction. And what we know is the more social media children are involved in, the higher anxiety and depression. The more screen time, if it's not social media, the higher levels of detachment, the more they struggle with social engagement, social interaction. Study after study after study. For some reason, we had a stone wall against all this research, and about 2-3 years ago, somebody started talking in the industry, and it all started flooding out, and now it's everywhere. There are some wonderful studies. I mean, it's easy to look them up. You know, like attention. Everybody says, well, attention deficit is something we have, it's always been around, we just never knew what it was. Well, that's bull hockey. That's not true. They don't have the numbers to prove it. We can go back 2 generations, and if that theory was true, then we would have all of those folks as adults right now that can't function, and they don't exist. They absolutely don't exist. And here's an example of what we know with attention. Playing first-person video games, a couple studies have been out in the last 2 years, increases a certain type of attention ability. It's the attention to pay. It's the ability to pay attention to random stimulus. You become a great scanner of what's stimulating. Makes sense. Somebody's shooting at you off a building, throwing something at you from behind a bucket. You want to know. So you get great at that. While that attention ability climbs, there is another one that falls. The ability to stay on task when bored. The ability to stay focused when unstimulated. You can't train both at once. It's amazing to me the number of children that parents bring in, and I tell the parents, I say, strip out all technology. You know, there's not a use for it anyway. I mean, there's not even a use for it for children at all while they're in your home. Not a direct need, in a sense. I mean, not that they can't use it for certain things to make certain things easier. You know, it's not a needed function. You know, how can a smartphone be a needed function if 10 years ago it didn't exist? Right? I mean, it's okay. So when parents strip those kids of all technology that struggle with attention, it's amazing the numbers of those children that begin to be able to deal with boredom better. It's unbelievable. Hope that answers your question. Any others? Yes, sir.
Your thoughts on Jordan Peterson.
Well, you got to tell me more. Well, I will tell you, a friend of mine that has now passed away worked background on mass killings. Not anybody you would ever hear in the news. Background investigations from Columbine, from the kid before them in Alabama, all the way up through high school and collegiate shootings. I've dealt a lot with Virginia Tech shooting. I'm right up the road from Virginia Tech. In every case that we have on record from, I forget the one, it was right before Columbine, it was a smaller one, but then there was Columbine. Moving forward, we have identifiable dysfunctional issues in the lives of those children that were either negated or ignored or treated therapeutically, meaning the more therapeutic we become, the less we actually deal with real issues. A person who behaves badly today, a person who behaves badly 20 years ago, we say that behavior is bad. Here's a consequence. Here's accountability. Here's a penalty. We're going to deal with that. And oh, yeah, then we may look at what's causing it. A person, a child, a teenager behaves badly today, we say, well, of course you behaved badly. Look at all this stuff going on in your life. We need to feel, and this is where we confuse two words, empathy and sympathy. We should have empathy. We should not be sympathetic. Because what they did was still wrong. So in all of those cases, that's what we find in the background. Things missed, things ignored, things that should have been dealt with differently, but because they were dealt with therapeutically, that's my opinion based on the information I know, we did not take hard stances that we needed to take. Other questions? Yes. Great question. 3 things I tell teachers. When I go to schools, often I will meet with faculty administration, try to work on a common language. And in the evenings, I meet with parents, and I try to give them the same language, and I warn them this is what I've told teachers. And when parents hear this information, they realize they need to do some things differently, typically. And what I tell teachers is this. Number one, be realistic. You cannot change your parents or your students. You cannot change your parents or your students. Do I need to say that one again? Because we keep trying to change them. We cannot change our parents or students. Number two, have developmentally appropriate challenges. Whatever you teach, have developmentally appropriate challenges. Make sure that the work, you know, rigor doesn't mean it should kill me. Although sometimes that's the way we do it, you know. Rigor should be challenging. We want to challenge you to go out of your comfort zone, to get away from what you absolutely know and are good at, to develop something new. You know, that's contemplation is a part of that. So we want to make sure we are providing those challenges and not shying away from them, because in the world we are today, the last thing in the world we want is a phone call from a parent, right? So if we're developing these challenges and being appropriate with them, we will get phone calls. This is the third thing for teachers. When you get a phone call because Johnny had Latin to do over the weekend, anyone ever gotten that one? Yeah. It's like my son, the guy with the beard, Latin 4. He was complaining. I said, dude, you're in Latin 4. You should have complained in Latin 1. I'm not listening. I mean, get over it. It's Latin. But when they call and they say, you know, Johnny had Latin over the weekend, and again, he had intramural water polo. Number one, thank you for calling. And you know what? I would love to let you know why Johnny has to do that homework. And this is where we lean in, and we lean in with truth. We know that healthy struggle is the engine to growth and maturity in the lives of our children. We know it. And because we know that, this is why we are doing this, and this is why Johnny has this to do. And, you know, we've been talking about this in class, and the children know that struggle is good, but sometimes it's hard. You say that, what do the parents say? They're confused. And I say that because I know many schools that have been doing that now, and they report back, parents are totally confused, because how can they argue with that? How can they say, well, that's a stupid idea? So I tell teachers all the time, you know, quit being defensive. When a parent calls, this is your opportunity to lean in and own what you are an expert with. And say, oh my gosh, I'm so glad you called. And you share that with them and say, would you love to come in and talk about more of that? No. They don't. If you master that as a teacher, that approach, thank you for calling. Oh my goodness, let me tell you not what I think. No, don't let me try to convince you of something. Don't let me soft pedal it. I'm going to microaggress all over you. I'm going to tell you what we know. And if what you share is healthy struggle is the engine to growth and maturity in the life of your children, they don't know where to go. And if they say, well, we don't really understand that concept, but it's interesting, refer them to a couple podcasts I did with Cersei. They go listen to them. Seriously. Other questions? Couple minutes. Yes, ma'am.
How do you begin to make changes for an older child who's already...
Oh, it's beautiful. Right, beautiful. We do, well, here. What do you do with an older child? What do you do with a teenager if you have wound them one way? And you realize, oh no, you don't go clipping all the wires. They go nuts. You can't do it. And I tell parents all the time, parents sit in my office, are you telling me I totally screwed up? And I go, eh. You know. Here's what I tell parents. If you have raised a fragile individual, the wonderful thing is they're still cooking. Don't go back and break bad. Establish a very simple connection. Number one, with the teenagers, I say this, and this hits adults a lot. What is the number one symptom of living like a child when you're not? Complaining. That hits home, doesn't it? Number one symptom of living like a child when you're not is complaining. So I tell parents to deal with teenagers, say, look, we're going to make this simple. The diagram of the three circles, Every teenager I know loves it when I explain it because they realize, so you're telling me if I'm demonstrating this, I can have big freedom and privilege. And I tell them about my son who at 14 would get on his bike and go ride 50 miles from home. He's a bike rider. Because he showed he could handle it. Kids, teenagers get that. But the simple model is this. Demonstration of responsibility and maturity. Responsibility is we give you things to do, you handle them, not a lot of fuss. You know, it's that respect, responsibility. And the demonstration of maturity is when you show you're handling things well, even when you don't want to, even when you don't feel like it, wherever that is for the teenager, freedom and privilege is right under it. So if your level of demonstration of responsibility and maturity is here, your freedom and privilege is right there. But if it's here, then this is what parents have a hard time with. You got to let the freedom and privilege roll. You got to build it up. So that's what I do with teenagers. And teenagers get that, and that allows them a path to begin developing some sturdiness. All right, one more question. Anybody? Anybody? Right there. Yeah, I well, that the anxiety and depression are two sides of the same coin. You never have anxiety without some level of depression. You never have depression without some level of anxiety. Most children, the bigger diagnostic category for children today is anxiety. Okay, children who really are faint-hearted, children who are weak. And what I do is with the children, I engage them in conversations about identity that they are made capable by God. And they just haven't experienced it. And so we begin coming up with how they can experience it. What I tell parents is you need to start stretching your children. Look at everything in your home that you do that they have physical capability to do and start training them and turning it over to them. I have kids that learn to cook. I have kids that learn to fix stuff. I mean, it's amazing. And what happens is they start realizing God has actually designed them for his mission. So he made them capable. And when that starts coming up in them because they're experiencing it, they're not faint-hearted anymore. I'm going to leave you all with one quote. If I can find it, Tacitus, Roman historian. The desire for safety stands against every great and noble enterprise. The desire for safety stands against every great and noble enterprise. Thank you all very much.